before we get to today's episode, I want to give a quick shout out to today's sponsor, Paperly. Paperly fills the gap in your traditional SIS or LMS and can save your school time and money. So check out their website at paperly.io. Now let's get to today's show. All right, welcome to Ed Leaders, the podcast covering all the interesting ideas about leadership, strategy, culture, and the business of K-12 education. I'm your host, Luke Keller, and joining me each week in the chair is my co-host and colleague, Matthew Irving. Today's guest is Gavin McCormick. Gavin is the co-founder of Upschool, has been a principal for over 20 years, has been on TEDx, and also Matt, the educator, recently announced Gavin as the most influential educator in Australia this year. And on top of that, he's chosen to join us on his birthday. So without further ado, let's get to it. Gavin, welcome to the show and happy birthday.
Thank you so much. Yes, it is my birthday. This is my birthday party.
Excellent. Well, we'll do our best, to help you celebrate.
Yes.
We'll have that door behind you open in a couple of minutes when we're halfway through the podcast with a cake coming through.
I was hoping that was going to happen. That's why I gave you my address.
All right. Now, we love to start the show with a little bit about you and your personal journey and your personal and professional journey in education.
So I guess going back to just before I was about to choose my degree topic, I was with my mum sitting in a house. I'd finished my A-levels and I said, hey, mum, like, what am I going to do? I've got all these choices. I did economics, geography, computer science and German. And, you know, I did all right. So I could have chosen lots of different courses. And she said, look, why don't you just be a teacher? Because you're really good with kids and you'll never work for the man. And, you know, I was 16. I was like, what do you mean work for the man? And she said, well, you know, like in lots of jobs, you end up just working and paying for somebody else's lifestyle. She said, imagine a really rich man driving around in a Bentley because you've worked really hard. You don't want to do that. And I was like, you know what? I don't want to do that. So she said, why don't you be a teacher and you'll always be working for society? So I just ticked teaching and applied to all teaching degrees and then went to university, became a teacher, and, you know, was really fortunate in the fact that I found my passion with my profession, like, straight away. I just loved it, and I was getting paid for doing it, you know, and I was good at it. So it was really cool. And then I, you know, did worked for a few years in the UK. Then I thought, look, you know, the huge world out there. I'm a young man. I'm a teacher. I'm off. So bye, mum. And I went to live in France. Then I went to live in Spain. Then I went to live in Korea. I've got the Trans-Siberian Express across China, getting off the train and teaching in different schools. It was far out. And then you know, I ended up in Korea. And anyway, after lots of years of traveling and teaching around the world, I ended up in Australia. And I needed a job very quickly because I had no cash. I would run out of money after all these traveling and, you know, eating all this wonderful food. I was like, God, I need a job quickly. How can I get a job quickly in Australia? And in my town in England, we have a lot of Pakistanis. It's very Pakistani-dominated. And it's beautiful, very, you know, very very culturally diverse, very harmonious, lovely place to live. But I'd worked in schools with Pakistani children, Muslim schools, and I'd learned to speak Arabic. I just learned how to recite the Quran by fluke. I didn't know what I was saying. I didn't know what it meant, but it just gone in my brain. And so I had all this cultural experience with Arabic and Islam, and I'm, you know, I'm not religious at all, but there was a job in a Muslim school in Sydney, so I just applied. Anyway, I went to the job interview and the principal sat me down and said, first of all, what do you know about Islam? So I just started speaking Arabic, but not knowing. I said, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rashim. Bismillahir rahmanir. Anyway, the lady's like, Alhamdulillah, it's amazing that you know how to speak Arabic. You've got the job. And, you know, I hadn't really even told her my credentials yet, but she was so impressed that I got this job in a Muslim school. I worked there. Ended up working there for 10 years. It was beautiful. It was absolutely beautiful to work there. There was children from Syria and Iraq, and, you know, they all come from war-torn countries, and it was just amazing. I loved it. Loved every minute. And then a government inspector came into school to do the inspection, and she said to me, hey, are you a Montessori teacher? And I said, no, isn't that a religion or something? A cult? I never heard of that. What is Montessori? She said, it's not a cult. What are you saying? She said, you need to go and have a look at a Montessori school. So I went to have a look at one. And it turned out that for the 10 years I was working in the Muslim school, the Islamic school, I'd kind of become this hybrid Montessori teacher without knowing. I'd give the children agency. I'd let them have a choice in what we taught. They'd teach some of the lessons and I'd learn from them. And it was just Anyway, it was very Montessori, so I went to look at a Montessori school, and I was like, goodness me, this is unbelievable. I love this. So I applied to be a Montessori teacher, transitioned, did a Montessori diploma, and then became a Montessori teacher over in Balmain in Sydney, and then became a Montessori principal of a school in Manly. And and here we are today on my birthday, loving life.
That is a lot packed into a short period of time, and you know, such passion and joy from all the things that you've done. Talk to us about, you know, that calling to vocation, that connection that you have with being an educator. What gives you the greatest fulfillment in the work that you do now?
I think, you always want to make a difference in the world, right? I mean, I'm not sure that everyone does, in actual fact, but deep down in your psyche, when you help someone or do something good, you feel good. Like, you just do inherently. It's built into our DNA. When we do something nice, we get this little trickle of dopamine into our bloodstream and we go, ooh, that felt good. I just, you know, I'm that snail that was walking down the street. I just moved it out of harm's way and put it on a leaf and walk away feeling a bit like a hero. Like, wow, I've done my bit in the world today. Now I'm going to go for a coffee. I can take on anything. And it's tiny, right? You do a tiniest thing and you feel good. And teaching gives you that opportunity, you know, to do that every day, all day, continuously. You walk in. You'd set up your classroom, the kids come in, you don't know what you're getting every day. You know, like, you never know what they're coming from. They've had an argument with their mum about their shoes in the house and everyone's been crying and, I don't want to wear these shoes, you're wearing those shoes. Anyway, they come in, they're very upset. You have that moment where you can be, you can change the world very quickly. They come in, how are you going, Tommy? I can see you're upset. Let's have a chat over here. Tommy suddenly, click your fingers, he's feeling fine again. You've moved the snail out of harm's way. You've been this, you know, you feel good. And you can do that 8 hours a day, nonstop, 24, you know, you can just do it all day, every day. And I think, you know, I just literally went to Notre Dame University and was talking to some of the undergraduates there about going into teaching and, you know, what are they walking into? And I said, you know, don't take this job lightly. Like, you get to be, you know, get to change the world every single day in every single classroom in the world. All these kids in your room are going to graduate and become, you know, the future leaders of tomorrow. They're going to make decisions. You get a chance to guide them to be leaders of tomorrow who are going to have ethics and morals. So for me personally, it's about exactly that. You know, yes, teaching is about learning how to know stuff. You've got to learn how to write and know mathematics and add fractions with different denominators. But you're also going to know how to be a good person. And you get a chance to do that every day, all day. And I don't think any other job in the world allows you to do that. You know, it's very hard to do something like that, especially with the youngest people. You know, if you look at a doctor or a nurse, they do. But, you know, people going to the doctors and going to the nurses are predominantly adults, you know. And if you go into teaching, you've got all these five-year-olds who are yet to live their life, are yet to know what they're about to walk into. And you get to craft their future for them and help them make their way through it as a good person. And I think, you know, that's where all my passion comes from. And it's not something I have to force. I just feel it because you can, you know, you get a chance to be wonderful 24 hours a day and it feels good.
Yeah, I think both Matt and I would say, I wish, you know, when Tommy was a teacher or an adult and they could come in and you could have a quick chat about what was going on at home or whatever, and then 5 minutes later they were feeling good again. But it doesn't always work that way with adults. But many of our listeners is probably, you know, they know about you through Montessori, about your championing of Montessori schools in Australia. And I guess I'm wondering, like, when you kind of transition from just being kind of the teacher and the principal of one school to really understanding that you were being the face of Montessori, or did you feel that at some point?
Look, when I discovered Montessori, it was quite interesting because the first moment I walked into the class and I sat down, this is what I saw, no word of a lie. And this will be quite foreign to most people who haven't seen it. So you walk into a traditional classroom and the teacher's standing at the front. There's a board, the kids are all sitting, and they're watching, and they're listening, and they're working, and it's great. And it's all one-way traffic, you know, a lot of the time. And I've worked in schools all over the world, and, you know, some countries different to others, of course, and some classrooms and some teachers different to others, of course. But predominantly, it's something like that. You walk into a Montessori classroom, it's very hard to find the teacher, first of all. You're thinking, where's the teacher in here? And she's behind the bookcase working one-on-one with a child. And you think, oh my goodness, child protection, what's going on in here? Where are the kids? Are they climbing out the window? They're not doing that. You've got a group of guys over here and they're building a volcano and labeling it. And they've got some books out. You've got some girls working in a partnership over there. They're doing, mathematics and they've got all these wonderful materials out. You've got a child working on the floor. He's got a map of the world. He's decided he's going to, you know, do the population count for every country on the planet. You've got all these kids working on different stuff all the time, everywhere. And they're all engaged, they're all working, and it's all in line with the curriculum, but they're all doing it independently, and they're all doing it at their own pace. And that's really important. They're doing it at their own pace, and they're doing it independently, which gives you, the teacher, and you know this, because you're teachers, the dream. Because you don't have to be continuously monitoring the class. Oh my God, are they talking? What's going on over there? Are they touching the scissors? Yes, they're doing all those things, but they know that they've got freedom within limits, and you can trust them, right? So I walked into a Montessori classroom the first ever day, and I thought, nothing's happening in here. Like, there's no teaching. Why isn't the teacher at the front? Why isn't the whiteboard on? Where's the diagram of a volcano? Why isn't she instructing and talking and distributing knowledge? And the more I spent in the room, the more I realized that she wasn't distributing knowledge. She was there to guide them. She was there to inspire them. So she'd say, we're going to learn about volcanoes, guys, but I don't know everything, because how could I? I'm not a volcanologist. I'm actually just Barbara. I'm a 42-year-old woman. I just looked it up last night on Google about volcanoes. I'm going to teach you about it, but I'm going to make it inspirational. I'm going to tell you the best, most inspirational stuff, right? I'm going to get you hooked. So, for example, let's say that you two were my students and I was teaching you about butterflies, right? You might think, oh, Gavin, really? I know everything about butterflies. I know what they are. I know how they grow. But do you know that butterflies taste with their feet? Do you know that? You don't know that, right? But they do. They taste with their feet. So you tell that to children and you have a model of a butterfly and you can show it and touch it and feel it and see it. And you say to the kids, what insect inspires you? And they say, well, actually, I love the ladybug. And say, okay, off you go. In 5 days' time, I want you to show me everything you've got about the ladybug. Off you go. You can work where you want. You can work with whom you wish. And you can represent your research in any way that suits you. Everything in this room is a yes. The pencils, the paper, the card. You know how to use them. See you on Friday, right? So just off they go. They're gone. Before you know it, they're ghost and they're engaged, right? They've got all their stuff and they're on it. They might be building a papier-mâché model, doing a report, making a diagram. Whatever they're doing it and they're learning. And she's continuously doing this. This is what the teacher was doing. It's almost like, you know, spinning plates on sticks. You know, that clowns have got all these plates spinning on sticks. If they're all spinning, you don't need to teach, right? When one starts to wobble, it means they're not engaged. You go over and you spin the plate, meaning you inspire them. And it's just another lesson. But you can do it one-on-one. You can do it in a small group. And she was doing this magically. So I saw it and I thought, why isn't anyone talking about this? Like, where's the person on top of the mountain shouting about Montessori? I've never heard of this. How come I thought it was a cult like 5 years ago? How come I never heard about it? So I decided that I was going to be that person. I just decided I was going to go to conferences and talk about it and had a big T-shirt. I'm a Montessori teacher. And after a while, I just, you know, became... I was going to wear it this morning. I'm a Montessori teacher, but I didn't want to. I just became the person who talks about it a lot. And, you know, here we are talking about it. So it's wonderful.
And it's interesting there's that narrative. And I wish you were wearing your T-shirt. No, I'm a Montessori teacher. And on the back, it's not a cult. You started to demystify, I guess, you know, preconceived ideas of what it is. And, you know, I'm really interested, I guess, on, you know, how do you counter some of those things? Because I imagine that you meet educators all around the world of all different persuasions, all different philosophies and practices. You know, is it that you go to that place and go, imagine if, you know, your classroom was a place of inspiring young people? What are some of the other narratives that you feel like you need to put out there to shape people's reimagining of what Montessori is?
Yeah, I mean, that's really a really good question. And of course, people love to hear stories and they love to hear real life examples of what it looks like. And so, you know, I have used many of these in my time in terms of putting it in perspective. Firstly, I will say, if you want to change anything in schools, you don't start talking to the teachers. That's not happening. You don't start talking to the principal. That's not happening. You know who you talk to? You talk to the parents. The parents are the powerhouses in schools. What they want, you will do. Because they're your customers at the end of the day. They're the ones sending in their wonderful little minions into your classroom and saying, make them into future leaders of the world. And so what they want, you will get. You'll have to do. And so you talk to parents. And so, you know, whenever I'm going to India on Saturday, actually, I'm going to do some work in Delhi with some very big schools, thousands and thousands of kids in these places, you know, 20,000 kids in these schools. And, you know, they want to change the way that they approach education. What I always do is I get all the parents in at the very beginning and I say, let's think about education. Because, you know, lots of parents, they've been through school. And so, and this is not just parents, but adults in general. They've been to school, so they think they know how to teach. They've been to school, so they think they know how teaching works. But teaching is a craft, you know, like you craft teaching. You become a master at it over many, many years. You know, you get to read body. No one gets to look at children and read body language as better, you know, as good as children. You can look 1 second, the tiniest little flicker in the eyelid, and you're like, he's struggling with his fractions. Let me just go over there. Like, you got it. The child doesn't want to have to tell you. You know, teachers very astute when it comes to reading body language and all these things. And this is something you craft over many, many years. But in order to change people's perception of Montessori, you have to have real analogies, of course. And so you talk to parents about this, first of all, because this is where it starts. So the one that I always use is one that every single parent has definitely done in their lifetime. And it's this. And it's something very recently we did at Upschool with thousands of schools all over the world. And I had an example this week I posted on LinkedIn. So we all, in every single curriculum in the world, there is writing a persuasive letter, right? It's in every, you've done it, you've taught it, you've also been taught it. Maybe you, it's in year 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 in the Australian curriculum. It's in every curriculum on the planet. So what happens in that progress of 10 weeks of learning how to write a persuasive letter is you learn about syntax, you learn the grammar, you learn sentence structure, you learn emotive language, you learn persuasive devices, you learn paragraphs, and finally, you learn the structure of a letter, right? And then you're ready to write your letter, which is amazing. And what generally happens is the teacher says, we're going to write a... Now you have all the skills in the world to write an amazing letter. We're going to write a letter to the principal, and we're going to ask him if he can make recess a little bit longer. Woo! Or ban school uniforms, or put chocolate in the canteen. And we've all written that letter. You might have even taught that lesson. I definitely have taught it, right? I've taught it maybe for 10 years. I feel guilty that I did that now. Montessori would never do that, right? So you write that letter to the principal, and the principal doesn't even read it because he's too busy on the phone talking to, you know, NAPLAN coordinators and getting, you know, the New South Wales Board of Studies are on the blower. They're coming in next week to inspect his program. And he's like, you know, there's no time to read 30 letters from stage 2 kids about changing the canteen. But the kids get the letters back from the teacher with a tick and maybe a score or a comment like, this is a great letter. And it goes in the file and nothing happens. Right? That's it. All of that work, syntax, grammar, sentence, nothing happens. Like the canteen still doesn't have chocolate. And I'm still wearing his terrible uniform. Why did I put 10 weeks worth of effort in? Montessori would never do that. The Montessori approach to that would be, before I teach you all of these skills, syntax, grammar, blah, 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 you're going to choose a problem in the world that matters to you. Let's go to the sustainability goals for the world. This is what we just did very recently at Upschool. Choose one of those that bothers you. And the girl says, you know what bothers me? Gender equality. That really bothers me. And you say, that's great. You choose that one. And another child says, climate change is really, you know, something I'm worried about because I heard that the Great Barrier Reef is being bleached and maybe when I'm old, I won't even get a chance to go there. Wonderful. You choose that one. So they choose an SDG or something that matters to them. And then they write, they learn all the skills for writing a letter. And when they're finished, you say, now you're going to write a letter. You're going to write a real letter. And we're going to post it to a real person who can change what matters to you. Let's find someone who can, you know, change the things that matter to you. So you might get, you know, the environment minister, the environmental man, you know, what's her name? Tanya Plibersek. A little boy this week in Upschool, he decided that what mattered to him was climate change. So he wrote a letter to Tanya Plibersek, the environment minister at the moment, environment and water. And he wrote a letter all about planting trees. You know, it's like, dear Tanya Plibersek, what matters to me is climate change. I'm worried that la, 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 I'd love to plant some trees. Could you help me? Come to my school. And he wrote a real letter. Now, he folded it up. You put it in an envelope. You put a stamp on it. And you say to little Tommy, you've got to write the address correctly. If your handwriting is not neat enough, because we say, right, you know, you've got to have neat handwriting. Who cares about neat handwriting unless it's got a purpose? Well, the purpose on the front of the envelope is the postman will not be able to read where to put your letter if you don't write it clearly. So suddenly it makes everything real, like everything becomes real, real life. And so you go to the postbox as a class and you post them. If you don't stick the stamp on correctly, it will not even make it. So they do these things and then you go back to class and you wait. And then Tanya Plibersek turns up at school and says, I got your letter and I'm here. And every child in the school goes, goodness me, with a piece of paper and a pen, I literally talk to anybody on the planet I want and I can change everything. And you, it's all about empowerment. And so that's the difference, the point of difference with Montessori is that you say to the children, what are you going to do with the skills you've just learned to make the world a little bit better? And it's very clear. And I think we can all take heed of that, because, you know, I've fallen in the rabbit hole too of just teaching stuff for the sake of teaching stuff, and because it's on the curriculum. And we need to move away from that. I think we need to think differently and make it real. There's so many opportunities to make it real. It's ridiculous. And kids love it, and you love it. And then when Tanya Plibersek turns up at school, it's fun. It's really fun, and all the kids are so excited. Everybody wants to write a letter. So, you know, that's the analogy I use, because every parent has had that lesson. Every parent has written that letter to the principal and felt that, well, nothing happened. And so, you know, it's amazing when you see that shift where you start to make learning real. I think we can all do that. And it makes learning a lot fun for everyone involved.
I mean, you talked there about parents being the customers of teachers and schools. You know, what are your thoughts on how Montessori is growing in terms of, you know, will parents that are in the normal system, are they starting to see the value of Montessori? Has that changed over the time that you've been connected with it? You know, I think there's probably a public perception of things that are alternate, and that Montessori might be an alternate type of education. Do you have a sense that you're moving the needle on that, and that more and more kind of what we would traditionally call the mainstream type of schooling is adopting more of the Montessori principles, you know, and how have you seen that change and develop over time for parents?
I think, you know, in my years as a school principal, I did a school tour every 2 weeks. So every 2 weeks, there was a school tour. You could book a spot to come and have a look at Montessori and decide if you wanted to come or not. And our school's up on top of the hill, you know, a bit out of the way. And so you had to make an effort to come and have a look. And what happened in those 4 years when I was school principal is that parents were coming from mainstream school. And when they saw it, when they walked into the class, it was almost a stampede to get to the office to put their name on the waiting list after they'd seen it, what I just described to you before. Because I think that if you think about, you know, the most innovative companies in the world, Airbnb, Google, Amazon, Wikipedia, SpaceX, you go to their offices, you see almost a replication of a Montessori classroom. There's people working on the floor, people standing up, people having a debate, people having a snack in the corner when at time that they choose. And there's this beautiful buzz. It's like a cacophony of conversation. It's not noise. It is noise. But there's work happening, and there's innovation, there's creativity, there's freedom and independence. And I think what's the big point of difference that makes parents want to think differently is because, well, obviously there's a lot of talk around NAPLAN and standardized testing and all of this stuff at the moment. It's everywhere. But there's a huge shift in what they want, what they expect success to look like. You know, they want their children, ultimately, if you're a parent, you want your children to be smart, and you want them to be happy, and you want them to be safe. You got those three things, then you're kicking all the goals in the world. And it's the happy bit that I think sometimes they lack, because what happens is, once you give students agency and independence, once you say everything in the room is yours, you can touch anything you want, it's all totally yours, and it's also mine. This is a 50-50 split. I live here, I work here, you live here, and you work here too. Children say, well, there's equality in here, there's equity. My teacher respects me, and she lets me do, or he lets me do things that I want to do. I've got a passion project on the go on World War II. It's not even in the curriculum. But what happens to the children is they develop all these skills, confidence, resilience, persistence, communication, time management, and they go home and they show these skills to their parents. You know, you'll find that the average Montessori child will walk up to an adult, any adult, and just shake their hand and introduce themselves. Hello, my name's Jonathan. I'm 10 years old. I go to a Montessori school. And the adult's like, hang on, you're 10? How come you just came up to me? Why aren't you playing over there on the floor and rolling around the grass? You know, and the child's like very confident to be able to do that. I've had children come up to me in my office and say, Gavin, can I use the telephone? And I'd say, you know, who do you want to call? I tried to say yes to everything at school. And said, well, we're doing a project on Myanmar, and we're actually raising money for children who are coming as refugees. And I'd like to call the CEO of this big charity organization, invite him into school to interview him. You know, those kind of children, they're 10, they're coming into your office. And you're like, wow. So word travels very quickly these days. Parents talk a lot. There's a big parenting groups all over the internet with thousands of parents. It just takes one parent to say, over at this school, my son is doing X. And parents want to see what that looks like. And I don't think, maybe it's not Montessori is not the answer. Maybe, you know, it's a hybrid, but I definitely feel that there's a change coming, and that change is where there is that independence, that is that agency. And I feel that the shift is on its way. There's no question about that. There's obviously the big problem we face is, you know, there's policies, there's documentation that's been sitting in our schools for many, many years, and it's hard to change things that have been there for so long. But recently we've been working down in Victoria at Lower Plenty, working in a primary school there. They're a mainstream primary school, and they want to transition to be a Montessori primary school. And so we're working with the teachers, with the parents, with the children. And we had a forum last week on Thursday, and all the parents came in. And one lady in the crowd, she's like, look, we did a talk, and she said, I'm a teacher in a mainstream school down the street. Aren't you going to bring my kids to this school? And, you know, I said, why is that? And she said, because on our website and on our branding, we have independent learning. We have all this agency, independence, program, you know, all this, but we don't do it all the time. We have a little window where it's allowed to happen. We say, now you can have some X freedom. She said, I want it all the time, you know, for my son, or as much as possible. And I think that's a shift that we're going to make. We're going to go down that route where, you know, like I said about the letter, we just need, I think ultimately we need to trust teachers to be able to teach. They're professionals. You don't go to the doctors and say, you're sure this is the right medication. You trust them. They're a professional. And teachers are professionals too. Trust them to teach. Give them the curriculum overview and say, look, there's all the topics. Teach it how you wish. I trust you can teach. And then teachers find their passion and go, you know what? I'm trusted here. So I'm going to trust my kids. And the kids go, oh my God, I'm trusted too. We're all trusted. And then learning becomes so fruitful, but it has to come from the very, very, very top and filter its way all the way down to the, you know, the desk of the student.
I want to take a quick minute to talk about our sponsor, Paperly. Paperly has been designed specifically to fill the gaps left by your school's administration system. It has modules which include excursion management, sports management, co-curricular, peripatetic music, online store, digital forms with workflows, integrated calendars, and much, much more. Even better, it integrates seamlessly into Synergetic and other SIS platforms and can be added on a module-by-module basis. So you can try out different parts of the product one piece at a time. Dan Dawson, the founder of Paperly, has worked in schools for over a decade, so he actually understands how schools and school IT systems work and therefore how best to integrate the product into your school setup. Check out paperly.oi today. That's paperly.io and have a chat to the team about a no-commitment trial in your school.
I think that's a really good sort of segue into creating a space and a system and an environment for teachers to do their best work. And, you know, and as you sort of describe the experiences you're having, there's always that sense from me that, you know, teachers are the most creative people we know. They're the most innovative, but they're constrained by a system that almost sucks the life out of them, you know, in terms of those natural innate, I believe, dispositions, if you like. You know, what are some of the other barriers that you see from teachers doing their best work, and how might we collectively nudge the system to open up those experiences so they can do their best work?
Well, the tables have recently turned, haven't they? It used to be the case where if you were a teacher, you were scrambling around looking for a job and you can find one. Now, all of the power's in the hands of teachers, which is amazing. They can pick their job. There's just no teachers around. Everyone's quit. And they've quit for a reason, just like you said. So, you know, I was recently doing a talk to a bunch of undergraduates, and I finished the talk and I said, listen very carefully to this final sentence I'm going to tell you. I said, when you walk out of this university and you go and apply for your job and you sit in the office with the principal and he offers you or she offers you the role, before you sign on the dotted line, you tell him or her, are you going to allow me to be the teacher that I want to be? Because I've left this university wanting to change the world. And if I'm going to come in this school and you're going to hand me a document and say those words to those kids, write the words in the book, tick them, show them to me so I can sign it off, then I don't want to work at this school. There's a school down the road, but possibly let me be the teacher that I've always wanted to be. And I don't think it's a fault of the principal. I think it's a fault of the system, like you said. And I think that's a really, really important point to make. I think the Australian curriculum is pretty good, to be honest with you, and I've worked with lots of curriculums around the world. If you think about it like this, and this is the way that I approach it with my teachers, and this is the way I've approached teaching myself, you know, in the curriculum, you have to teach history. Okay, history's in there, and you look at ancient civilizations, right? You know, it's a broad topic. If you're talking about ancient civilizations, just because we're in Australia it doesn't mean that we have to teach a particular civilization because we're here, right? Of course, you know, indigenous culture, indigenous, you know, history is embedded into our curriculum, and that is not a problem whatsoever. But you as a teacher, you might be Chinese, you might be from South America, you could be from North America, right? So you personally have this attachment to another history, another line of history. So you come into class and you say, this term we're going to be learning about ancient civilizations. Before we even start talking about anything in the curriculum, let me tell you my personal story. My name is Mr. Johnson. My father was an ex. I'm from North Carolina. And we're going to talk a little bit about, and the children, and you know, you bring in some photographs of your uncle and your granddad or whatever it's going to be, and a map where you used to live or where you were born. And you go down that route. And because it's tied to you as the teacher, it comes out so passionately. And then you say to the children, hey, you know, where are you from? Where's our heritage? This is the most multicultural country on the planet, right? What's your heritage? Well, my dad's Korean. My grandfather's Chinese. My uncle is from Romania. Wonderful. Okay, right. Let's start off. Before we even get into the curriculum, let's talk about us. Let's find out something about our culture, our history, and then we'll go into the curriculum in week three. No problem. So every single child has this ownership and has a personal touch to what they're about to learn. Sometimes things are so far away from our children that they don't have any concept of being able to feel that it's tangible. And we can make it real by demonstrating it ourselves. Montessori said, model the behavior you wish to view in your children. What you are, they will be, right? So you start off by telling your story, and then you say to them, I want to hear your story. What's yours? Give me your voice. You're from Afghanistan. You're from Iraq. You're from Mesopotamia. You're from the oldest civilization. You know, whatever it's going to be. And then you get into what's in the curriculum. But that ownership, I think, and that touch that is personal to the students is very, very important. And the Australian curriculum actually allows for that. You know, when you're teaching continents, there are seven continents. You don't have to teach Antarctica just because it's over the way. And do, you know, emperor penguins and Weddell seals. You don't have to do that. Yeah. It's in the curriculum. You don't have to do the gold rush. You know, you don't have to do the gold rush. It's in the curriculum. You don't have to. Yes, it's a wonderful story. There's a trillion stories, right, that are wonderful. So what, you know, and so pick the story that matters to you as the teacher, and pick one that you, if you've just finished reading a novel, you know, on Sir Douglas Mawson or whatever it's going to be, and you thought, that was an amazing story, I'm going to tell the kids that story. Then you start off with that and then say, now, you can pick a continent. Which continent would you like? Well, I'd like to do Asia. I'd like to do, you know, Africa. Wonderful. Let's go. And so everyone has agency. Everyone has independence. And I think that explanation to teachers is very important to say, just because I've got this pre-made document on Antarctica that Barbara made 10 years ago, you don't have to teach it. It's just a guideline. And I'll give it to you as an example. But if you don't like it, then reinvent it. And what you will find at that point, like you said, teachers are extremely creative. They will stay up all Sunday night preparing this amazing, we've all done it. And you know, we've all done that, and every teacher listening will know this. When you have got an amazing lesson waiting in the pipeline, right? You've got all your stuff ready. It's in your house. You've bagged up all your materials. You've got everything ready. You're actually really excited to get to school because you're like, I'm ready. This is going to go really well tomorrow. The kids are going to be totally all over this. And that feeling is a really good feeling to have. You know that. Look at you both smiling. It's a really good feeling. I mean, it probably goes really wrong the next day. No, it goes really right. It's really good. but if you don't have ownership over it, then you take away the freedom. And, you know, I'll say this publicly, but, you know, I was really sad the other week to see that over in New South Wales, we were trying to help the teachers here. You know, they've got a problem with workload and everyone's overworked and stressed. So what did we do? We decided to give them lesson plans. You know, we'll give you some pre-populated lesson plans to save you time. What we did at that point, we said, well, the only creative spark you have of designing your own lessons, we're going to do that bit for you. So we're going to tell you what to teach. And so, you know, I don't think that was the answer, to be honest with you. But like you said, teaching is a creative task. It's a craft. It's an amazing art. And teachers are amazing people. So give them the freedom to teach and the trust, and let them use the curriculum in a way that suits them. The outcomes can be ticked in many, many ways. It doesn't need to be so direct.
One of the things that we like to kind of dive into is, you know, the leadership journey that people go through. And I'm interested in kind of that transition for you from being kind of the classroom teacher into leading a school, and over time, the challenges that came with that. and comparing those challenges of running a smaller school in comparison to, you know, what it might be like to run like that school that you were talking about in India with 20,000 students.
Obviously, it's very daunting to go from school teacher teaching stage 3 kids, 30 kids, to go to school principal just with one jump. I remember sitting in the back garden of a friend's house and saying, oh my goodness, what am I doing? Like, I go to the beach every day at 4 o'clock after school. I just finish and I mark all my books and I'm out the door and I'm gone. I'm at the beach having a swim with my mates and it's lovely and the sun's setting. You know, I'm going to be under the pump when it comes to running an entire school. And I've got to say, like, when I was running the small school, it was beautiful because I had a really supportive board. You know, I had a board on the school, independent school, and they were really great, amazing. I had my back. They were, you know, supporting me the whole way, which was brilliant. And so I was very honest in the interview with the when I went for the principal's role. I said, look, you know, I've never done this before. I'm very passionate and I work really, really hard, but I'll need a lot of help. Because I've never seen a policy before. You know, I've never written a school policy or I've never been to a board meeting. What's a board meeting? You know, what's a financial, you know, I don't know about looking at a spreadsheet. You know, these things are really tricky. And suddenly you're in a small school and you don't have this big department. You can't say, oh, Barbara, you're the head of English. Can you deal with that? Or where's my HR manager? You're literally doing everything. You know, you're running the school events. You're when a teacher's away, you're teaching the class. Because there's no relief teacher, so you're in the class teaching. Then, you know, the Department of Education are coming in to inspect your programs. You're doing that. You're guiding your teachers along writing new programs. And at the very beginning, it was really tricky because, you know, you have to take it's a very interesting concept because you want to be liked, actually. You want all of your staff to like you. You want to be, you know, you read all these leadership books and you listen to all these leadership podcasts and they're like, trust your teachers. Be the guy, you know, model the behavior you wished of you. Get into school, be the first into school and the last to leave. You know, those kind of things. And it's very hard to do that all the time. And, you know, managing a huge cohort of people, you're managing the kids. So the kids are coming to school and you've got to look after the kids. And the teachers are looking after the children. And then the parents, you know, the parents are all out in the community and you're looking after their parents too. And everyone's got anxiety around everything. So making a kind of safe haven for them all, I think, is the trickiest part. Really, really tricky, making sure that everyone feels comfortable. I mean, it takes a lot of work because you've got to be everywhere. You've got to be on the door in the morning, shaking every child's hand. Good morning, Stephanie. How are you feeling? Good. Off you go into class. You have the greatest day. Off you go. Then you pop into class. Everything okay to the teacher? Going well? Going well, Gavin. No problem. Then you're on the phone. Parents are ringing you up. Gavin, I'm a bit worried about this was said on the playground last week to my son. And what are you going to do about it? You know, you're kind of working all these things at once. But I think once you get into a position where people know you and they trust you that you know what you're talking about, you can then start to relax a little bit. Not that you can ever really relax as a school principal, but you know that people know what they're getting when they come to your school. That the teachers go, well, you know, if I'm 5 minutes late, it's not a problem. Gavin knows who I am and he probably understands that this has happened on the way to school. And if I need to leave early, that's totally fine. You know, and if I need some assistance, I can just go to the office and Gavin's there and give us some advice. But similarly, I don't know everything either. So I would go to the staff and say, look, I need some advice on this. I don't know what to do at this point. And it's kind of like running a really big classroom. You know, you've got your class and it's the same kind of dynamics. You know, you trust the kids, they trust you. Same with your teachers, same with your parents. But a small school is a really interesting one because when you've got a small school, you get to turn it into a powerhouse. You know, for many years, I've been building schools in Nepal. For the last 5 years, every school holiday, I would fly to the Himalayas and build a school just for fun because I like going to Nepal and it was fun to do good work like that. Then I took over a school and then I suddenly had all of these parents and children and they wanted to help. I said, oh, we heard that you built schools in Nepal. Want to help? I was like, okay, you can. And so you say to the children, right, we're all going to dress up and we're going to run a fun run together, dressed as a chimpanzee or a granny or something. We're going to raise 20 grand. We're going to build a school. And the kids are like, we're doing it. And the whole community comes, all the teachers, all the parents, all the kids. And you really get to model behavior you wish to view in your child. Because suddenly you don't have 30 kids. You have 500 people who are willing to do that. And the influence you have is very big and you get to do wonderful stuff. So, you know, together we did some amazing things. We built a huge school down in Noel Parasi, which is on the border of India and Nepal, for 500 children. And the children came in my school with suitcases filled pencils and rulers and rubbers and books, and I shipped them all over to Nepal and built this enormous school. And the kids just loved it so much, you know, it was brilliant. So I loved it. I did love being the principal of a school. It was really fun. And, you know, I would recommend it. But most people jump from, you know, teacher, they go to deputy coordinator, then they go to, you edge into leadership. I just went straight into the top, and I enjoyed it. It was tricky, I won't lie to you, but it was fun along the way. I think the secret is having a supportive board and having a supportive parent cohort. You know, meeting all your parents and saying, this is who I am. This is what the school's going to do. This is what I think education looks like. This is what I want for your children. And the parents say, we want that for our children too. Go for it. You know, we're right behind you. So I think it's just to be clear in what your expectations are.
Gavin, one of the things you've been sort of talking there about, you know, the concept of your own, experience, you know, outlining your own journey and some of the things that, you know, you've sort of learned along the way. Now you're in this space where you're shaping systems, you're building schools in Nepal and the like. Along with building those schools and infrastructure is shaping learning and shaping education and shaping leadership. So how are you going about sort of shaping, you know, generations of leaders in the schools that you're building?
Well, look, you know, building schools in Nepal is something I've been doing for a long time. And I just did it as for fun. And it's just, I thought I'll just go to the Himalayas and just start and just see what happens. So I just flew there one day and I met a guy who was running a training center, and I said, look, you know, let's fix this training center. It's not that great. It's terrible, in fact. Let's fix it up. And he's like, you know, I'd really love to fix it up. And it was just an old dusty room in the back streets of Kathmandu, a place called Bag Bazaar, Tiger Market. But the guy was lovely. So I came back to Australia. I ran the city to surf dress as a granny. I raised about 10 grand. I bought all this stuff. I flew back there and we made it into this amazing training center. And all these ladies from the Himalayan mountains came down from the mountains into Bag Bazaar, and they trained for 3 months and they went back to their villages, and they taught differently. They started teaching differently. All the things that we're saying now about agency and independence, they started teaching differently and approaching education slightly differently. And, you know, change happens very slowly in education because you're working with children. So in order to see the fruits of your labor, they've got to grow up and they've got to become people who are actually in the community and, you know, acting the way that you want them to act and following a moral compass that you want them to follow. So, I mean, that was beautiful and brilliant, and I will obviously continue to do that. But more recently, you know, me and my co-founder, Richard Mills, down in Melbourne, we're both teachers. And, we, you know, we've opened a website called upschool.co, and we opened in January. And we had an idea where we could influence lots of children around the world through technology. So during the pandemic, we had this interesting story where I was at school in Manly teaching my children, and I'd be designing lessons. And I was spending all night putting them together, you know, on how a snail pollinates a flower, for example, right? So I'd have all of this material, I'd have overhead cameras, all this stuff. And all these kids would come to school, 50 children in a primary school in Manly would come to school, and I would teach this lesson, and I'd spent 5 or 6 hours putting it together, and I was really proud of it. Like we were saying before, it's like, this is an amazing lesson. And I'd send the link out to these children, and there were 50 of them. And then, you know, I started talking to Richard Mills as a teacher down in Melbourne, and we've been friends for a long time, and we decided, why don't we actually just build a school online where we send a link out and everybody in the world can come to school for free. And it's a link. You know, like if you go to Microsoft Teams, you can have 40,000 kids in a meeting. And if each one of those people coming to your meeting is a teacher and they're on a screen and there's 70 kids in a class, like do the maths. It gets very big very, very quickly. So I left my job as a school principal, and Richard Mills and I opened upschool.co. And so we started making lessons like I've just described to you, like, you know, courses about writing a book to change the world, or, you know, taking on an SDG and changing the way that your community operates, or, you know, everything, all these wonderful courses and all these wonderful lessons that were real and purposeful. You know, our whole intention was to design purposeful education for a better tomorrow. That's the whole thing. That's our whole concept. And so we've been doing it for 8 months now. And, you know, we've got thousands and thousands of kids all over the world come to school every single day. And they come to school and every single lesson is purposeful. So, you know, just like I was saying to you before, we had a child this week, his mum sent me a letter saying, this week my son has decided that he wants to save the Daintree rainforest. So he's written a letter to Tanya Plibersek, telling her about his woes and how she can help. And I think, you know, that is what education needs to look like. And for me personally, the use of technology, and Montessori is very, you know, we don't use a lot of technology in Montessori. We kind of steer away from it, to be honest with you. It's all tactile, hands-on materials. But from a teaching perspective, and if you want to do something global, and there's a link that just goes out, and 40,000 kids can come to school from Romania, from Uganda, from Afghanistan. You know, we have children on our platform coming from Syria, Afghanistan, Ukraine, Libya, Romania, places you could never get to do any teaching, but they've got the internet. They click a link and boom, they're at school. And the school is purposeful, it's got intention, it's good quality. I'm not saying I'm the best teacher in the world, but you know, me and the team put together these amazing courses on stuff which we think is really important and in line with the curriculum. But at the same time, alongside that, we try to make sure that in every single lesson, there's a video for the teacher to say, hey, teacher, this week we're going to be talking about this. And this is why we're going to be asking your children to write to a real person. And hopefully the trickle effect will mean that teachers around the world will say, you know what? I'm not going to write that letter anymore to the principal. That's not happening. The canteen is not changing. The school uniform hasn't changed. Every time now, we're going to write to a real person. Let's do that. And fingers crossed that over, you know, a long period of time and with a lot of effort, that things will change. And our children, like you said, our children will grow up to be confident, resilient, persistent, determined, and they will know that they've got the power to change the world, because you can't have them just falling in line again. You know, we can't have what's going on right now. I'm a product of that system, and so are you. And so, you know, I wish that I'd have grown up slightly differently, where I'd have made different choices about the things that I did so that the world wasn't in such a pickle as it is today. But we've got a chance. You know, we've got all these children sitting in classrooms. I always say the future sits, you know, behind the classroom door of every classroom in the world, you know. And we've got a chance to craft that as we wish. And right now, me and the team at Upschool, you know, we're trying very, very hard to do that. And, you know, I would say to any teachers out there, want to have a look, like, go and have a look. And if you like it, then I hope I can see you there. It'd be wonderful.
Now, I did see a recent promo video of your expedition to the Arctic. And it seemed to me that you might have been channeling your best David Attenborough. I'm not sure. But one of the things I did notice about that video was obviously the partnership with Aurora, I think it was.
Yeah.
And I'm just interested in what you can kind of describe or talk about with that partnership and, you know, many other partnerships that I know Upschool does, because it's not something that a lot of schools play in that space of developing those types of partnerships.
That's right. The reason we get partnerships like that, and the reason we approach those, I mean, recently we made a partnership with Jane Goodall Institute. That's huge for me. Jane Goodall is a personal hero of mine. So, you know, and I'll give you an example. I'll talk about the Arctic in just a second. I'll give you an example of the Jane Goodall one, which I think is really beautiful. So the idea, the concept is, and we've talked about this for the whole podcast, making learning real, make it purposeful. Children do something, they make something, they do some work, let's call it, and then something happens, like something real happens every single time. So to make it simple, if a child says, can I make a poster? You say, before I say yes, tell me what the poster's for. Well, the poster is because I want to, there's a pond at the bottom of the hill, and there's litter in the pond, and I want to make a poster for the post office to tell people to put their litter in the bin because we're going to poison the ducks. You say, go and make 1,000 posters like that. That's amazing. You know, yes, you can definitely do that because it's going to make a difference. So if you talk about partnerships, and especially the one with Jane Goodall, which I think is amazing, we've got children right now. We've got this course called Write a Book to Change the World, right? It's totally free. Kids all around the world are doing that course right now. So what they do is, and I guide them along the way, they choose a why. Why are you writing a book? What's the reason? Number two, they choose a topic. What are you writing a book about? Number two. They then write a manuscript. They then edit it. They then illustrate the book, completely illustrate it on their own. And then they publish it. And we have an online library where you can publish your book, and they upload it. And a book appears, a real book, that actually can be sold and bought all around the world. And, you know, we've got the Upschool Library. People are buying these books all around the planet. And what happens is just before little Tommy uploads his book, it says to him, hey, Tommy, when someone buys your book, where do you want some of the profits to go? And he has these charity partners that he chooses. And a drop-down menu appears and he says, oh, that one matters to me because I Love Animals, Jane Goodall Institute. When someone buys my book, I want some of the profits to go to Jane Goodall. So he uploads it and he chooses a charity that matters to him. So we've got a charity called So They Can. They rescue girls in Uganda from marriage, from underage marriage, right? We've got charities, Rainforest Rescue. They plant trees in the Daintree rainforest. So child goes, what matters to me? And they choose one that matters and they upload their book. Now, Luke, you go on the Upschool Library and you buy the book, right? There's a book called Heaven Restored. It's so beautiful, goodness me. A little boy in Delhi wrote it. It's about the earth being coming back to life, about the trees growing and the plants and the insects. It's beautiful. You bought one of his books. A little message appears to him saying, hey, by the way, Ahmed, someone just bought your book and you just planted 12 trees in the Daintree. You know, there's a book on there called Callum the Cloud. A little girl in Victoria has written it about two clouds who make friends. When you buy one of her books, she gets a little ping saying, hey, by the way, you just rescued two girls in Uganda and they're now going to be going to school instead of going to underage marriage. Like, that is totally out of control. Like, I get shivers down my spine just thinking about it. And the other night, I interviewed a little boy from Calcutta. He'd written this book, and I wrote to his mom and I said, do you mind if I interview your son? It's 14. He's written this beautiful book. And it's like something you would buy in Dimmocks. It's out of control how good it is. And I interviewed him and I said, you know, well, how do you feel? How do you feel now that someone's bought your book and you're 14 and you're planting trees? Oh, no, he was repairing children's eyesight at the John Fawcett Foundation in Indonesia. How do you feel that you're actually giving children the chance to be able to see again? And just this big smile, bigger than I can possibly imagine, just appeared filling the entire screen. Like, he got the feedback he needed. It wasn't a tick. It wasn't a point. It wasn't a score. It wasn't a percentage. And it wasn't a ranking. It was that emotional feeling to say, I did this work. I made that effort. And the difference is that someone's life has improved. And so that's the whole thing. That's in every single lesson that I've always tried to teach. It's certainly in everything that we have on Upschool. And so going to your question about the Arctic and Aurora, I found when I was in the Himalayas that there was a big disconnect between what we were trying to teach our students and what was real to them. So I'll give you a perfect example. I met a lady in a place called Carvre. Carvre is up in the mountains. I was building a school there for a long time in the mountains. I knew all the people in the community. This lady went down to the river basin. It was an empty river basin. There was no water in it. But it's about a kilometer along that I could see. There's no water at all. And she poured this huge dustbin filled with Coca-Cola and Mountain Dew bottles into the river basin. It was already filled with plastic, filled to the brim with plastic. And I said to the lady, excuse me, and I knew her, so it wasn't, you know, an encroaching conversation. I said, hey, you know, can I ask you, why do you put all the rubbish in the river? And she said, oh, don't worry. When the rains come, it all just goes away. And I said, do you know where it goes? And she said, no, I actually don't know where it goes. And I said, I'll tell you where it goes. So it goes down into the Ganges, and then it goes into the Bay of Bengal. It ends up in the Arabian Sea, and the fish eat the plastic. And then you eat the fish. So you eat the plastic. And she said, I've never seen the ocean, and I've never tasted a fish. And she walked back to her house. And so in my mind, I was like, you know, when saying to the kids, save the ice caps, who's seen an ice cap? You know, we're saying to the children, take care of the Arctic, take care of Antarctica. And they're going, well, you might as well tell me to take care of Jupiter. That's how close it is to me. Like, it's very far away. You know, it's not tangible. I can't possibly do anything about that. So with the, you know, you want to make it real, as I've said to you before. So the idea with Aurora and with the Arctic was me and the team at Upschool, we went to Aurora and we said, hey, guys, we've got this idea. You go to the most remote places on the planet, right? You go to the Arctic, you go to Antarctica. Can we come? And they were like, you know, why? And I said, because, you know, we'll bring a film crew with us. Me and my co-founder, Richard Mills, we'll bring a film crew with us. And in front of a glacier, we'll teach a lesson on glaciers. In front of a polar bear, we'll teach a lesson on polar bears. And I had, you know, I did this pitch and they were amazing. Got to say, they were like, get on the boat right now. Like, this is something that's needed. You get on this boat and you go to the Arctic immediately and do that. So it was amazing to do that. And we went. But I never thought that I would be able to teach a lesson with a polar bear over my shoulder. But then it happened, you know, and you'll see it. This course starts on October the 10th. It's far out. It's out of control. I'm writing the content right now. So I'm on a little boat, it's called a Zodiac. I'm about 100 meters from the biggest ice cap in the world. And I'm going, hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's lesson on polar bears. This week, we're going to be talking all about the apex predator in the Arctic. Did you know? Anyway, and I say, take a look over my shoulder. No word of a lie. About 50 meters
you
behind
me. You do sound like David Attenborough.
Yeah. Behind, 50 meters behind me on the ice, there's a 700 kilogram polar bear just walking along the ice, you know, just doing its business. And then we send this out to the world for free. You know, we say, you want to learn about why it's important to take care of the ice? Well, I'm your teacher, and it's right there. It's right behind you. And, you know, there's calls to action. The kids have got to do stuff. You know, they do these wonderful things in all part of the learning. But it's that one step away. You know, your teacher's there. You know, you're like, it's right there. Like, it's right behind me. The polar bear's right there. And so hopefully, and this is the concept, the children will have this relationship with it. It'll be more tangible to them to say, you know, actually, I would love to see a polar bear. I don't want it to be extinct. Or I understand how ice is connected to me. Like, that's the whole idea. If there's no ice, there's no you. And that's the connection between the, you know, two. Trying to make it, bring it back to the people who are doing the learning. Because I think we do that a lot. We teach big concepts, but it's too far away from our students. So we want to bring it real. And just to give you a heads up, we're actually going to Antarctica in March to do exactly the same thing. And the dream in my mind is to sit in a colony of King Emperor penguins, 500,000 of them, bang in the middle, and teach a lesson on penguins. So we'll see how it goes. I mean, it could be very cool.
Gavin, it's just...
I think it will be very cool.
Yeah, so cool. And it's just, you know, you speak of just have so much life and so much energy and creativity and, you know, you're breaking down barriers and creating, you know, a system that's equitable and that's accessible to young people around the world. And for me, there's this transformational piece. And I guess as we move into like these final parts of our conversation today, just a personal reflection, how do you maintain that drive, and that energy? How do you manage yourself knowing that you can do all these amazing things, but you can't do necessarily everything? What are some of the things that you do to ensure that your bucket's full so you can be giving our kids everything?
First thing I would say, and this is probably really, really important, is, you know, if you're working in an environment where it's slightly toxic, you're not valued or you're not respected, it will drain you. It will, you know, the energy will run out of your body, you know, very, very quickly. I personally am very fortunate in the fact that the team that we have right now that we're working with Upskill, that we've got a big team. You know, we've got people in the North Coast, in the Northern Rivers, Melbourne, in Sydney here, over in India. We've got people working in Nepal, people working in Bangladesh. We've got people all over the place working on this same mission. And we've got schools all over the world coming to school. And they are beautiful, honest, noble, thankful, gracious, empathetic people. And I feel, and the whole team, it feels exactly the same. It's not just us. We're part of this entire ecosystem of teachers around the world who want to do something great, and they want their children to be wonderful leaders and save tomorrow. So if you know that that's happening and we all feel the same way, then, you know, you can't help but want to do it. You know, if I show you a box full of 10 kittens without a home, you'll want to save them all. People are like, I've got to find a home for these kittens. Like, that's my mission. I'm on it. And, you know, I feel very similar to that. Like, you know, and the whole team at Upskill, we're like, hey, all these schools around the world, they want something different. Let's give it to them. Let's do it. And so, you know, we'll find that I've never worked so hard. In fact, the team, we've never worked this hard in our life. But because it's such a mission that we're on, and it's such a beautiful one, and we get the real results, you know, we don't get grades, points, scores, percentages. We don't want those. But what we do get as a team is, we get emails from teachers in Calcutta saying, by the way, this week we've decided to take on SDG 13 and we've painted our entire school. The kids have painted it with messages of things that we can change in our community. Or, you know, there's a school in Delhi who writes us an email saying, on a Wednesday now, the entire school community walks to school. We've got Walk to School Wednesday thanks to the course that we've done on the Upskill platform. And like, that's the grade, the point, the score, the percentage that I need. That's all I need, and that's all the team needs. So, you know, that's what we'll continue to do. And you can't stop doing that because it feels so good, and you know, we're all in the same boat. But personally, you know, I try to look after myself. You know, I'm 44 today. I'm getting on a bit. You know, I try to go to the gym. I try to eat healthy. I drink lots of water, all those wonderful things. But, you know, I try to do fun stuff. I'm a rock climber. So, you know, I go to the mountains and go rock climbing, and I have downtime where I try not to do anything. But you know, it's very hard when you're on a mission, because it doesn't feel like work. Like, this doesn't feel like work. This is like something bigger than that. And it's never felt like work in actual fact. It only ever felt like work when I had a toxic principal who didn't value me, and I left that school. You know, I left very quickly. But as soon as you're respected and you're trusted, and you're valued, it doesn't feel like work anymore. And you can do it forever because it feels so good. And you end up getting paid for it, which is even more brilliant. You know, you get to live your life and do the thing that you love. So, and I think that's why most teachers go into teaching. You know, you want to go into teaching because you want to change the lives of the children in front of you. And that's crucial.
Yeah, just that, you know, that the teaching for you, Gavin, sounds like it's not a job. It's one that's driven by purpose and mission. And then when you are driven by those things, it doesn't seem like work. It brings you joy. It brings you fulfillment. And it keeps you going. And so going to work every day is fun. And shouldn't that what teaching be? You're like, well, why is it not that? And I think you're really challenging us this morning about getting back to why we got into teaching in the first place. And it can be that reality. It doesn't just have to be an idea.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think every teacher goes into teaching for that. You know, you want to go in front of your class. You want to build the leaders of tomorrow. And you want to change the world. And we definitely can. You know, we just have to keep that as our own, you know, personal objective. You know, there are all these things we've got to cover. There are, you know, all these things we've got to do. But ultimately, what you need to be able to do to keep your bucket full, as you said, is to make sure that you're having fun along the way and that you have some agency as a teacher over what you're teaching and how you're delivering it. Because when you become a robot and you teach it, you know, how somebody else tells you, you lose the spark, and it doesn't feel good to be, you know, to be in that position.
Now, I actually think you've got a secret that you're not telling us, and that's that you have 48 hours in your days instead of 24 like the rest of us, and that's how you get so much done. But to wrap up our conversation, we love to kind of finish on a crystal ball note and kind of talk about where you see the future of education going over the next decade or two.
Where do I see a future of education going? Well, it's a very big question and a very interesting one. I mean, there's so many avenues that education could take. I think we're all looking at Sweden and Denmark and Norway at the moment, and we're talking about, you know, the future of education, how it looks. What they do and what many schools around the world are doing now is that it's all about freedom. It's all about, you know, giving the students freedom and having trust in your pedagogy. I think that as educators, you know, we call it our classroom, but the reality is it's an environment, to be honest with you. It's an ecosystem. And we need to think of our classroom like, the most innovative, creative office in the world, where everything is yes, and we trust that the students can use that space. You know, there's still schools in the world where when children want to go to the toilet, they have to put their hand up, okay? Now, that's the teacher saying, I don't trust that your brain and your bladder can communicate correctly. When your bladder's full, your brain will tell you you need to go to the toilet. I don't trust that. I need you to ask me first permission for that to happen. I don't think, you know, that's the basics. You know, if your brain tells you need to go to the toilet, go to the toilet. You don't put your hand up. You don't ask me that. If you want to use the card, use the card. If you want to use the pencils, use the pencils. You know how to do all those things. But here are the rules. Here are the freedom within limits. Here's the trust. I can trust you if you do these things. And so when you do go to the bathroom, you go to the bathroom and you come back to class. I can trust that you can do that. It's a very simple thing for you to do. When you need the card, you can use the card. But you can't use all the card because we need that card as a class. And if it runs out, there'll be no card. And when Tommy wants to build a volcano, there'll be no card to do that. And so there's this collective responsibility that it's not just a classroom. This is a society. This is a community in here. And we all need to work together for this to become a place that we all enjoy. And I think that the shift away from having a curriculum or a pedagogy or a philosophy or a culture in your classroom where I am the teacher, I am the oracle, I know everything, you know nothing. I'm now going to distribute what's in this brain here into your brain. If you remember what I say and you answer the questions on Friday, then that is a wonderful job and we can all put big fat ticks all over everything. Like, I see that going out the window. That's gone. I think that that's something we're about to say goodbye to. Because if we make this shift where we say to teachers, hey, you know, just make it real. Just make it inspirational, get the kids going, and when the kids are on their way, trust them that they can use this room in a way that suits them. They can sit where they want. They can use the things that they need, and they can produce their research in a way that suits them. What that happens to the children at that point is they feel trusted, and they feel comfortable, and they feel happy, and they feel content. But better than that, they develop a set of skills that are hidden in the curriculum. You know, you can't teach confidence. You can't say to the kids, hello, everybody, today we're going to learn about confidence. And by the end of this lesson, you're all going to be confident, or resilience, or persistence, or determination. You can't teach those things. But you can have experiences in your classroom that let them manifest themselves. So when you say, off you go, everybody, and on Friday, you're going to show us what you know about volcanoes, and you have a little group session, and the kids come. Two kids have got a diorama, three kids have got a model, these kids have written a play, that child over there has done a diagram, and they all come, and they all present. Some of them get it wrong. Some do this thing wrong. Some drop their diorama on the floor. But that builds confidence, right? That's what confidence is. And you can't teach it, but you can learn it through experience. And I think that if we're trying to develop and cultivate leaders of tomorrow, we need people with empathy and love and compassion, understanding, determination, persistence, resilience. We need all these things, and you can't teach them, but you can let them happen. And the sooner you let them happen in your classroom, then the better the world will be for the future. And I think that will be where the education system is going, because you say that to anybody, and you're doing it now, and everyone starts nodding. They're nodding, saying, yeah, that's right, man. That's cool. That's what we want. Because we have adults who don't have confidence, you know? They don't have resilience, persistence, empathy, understanding. If you can get that stuff when you're six, then when you're 60, you'll be, you know, amazing. And so if we want to save the world, we want to make it a better place for everybody, then these things need to happen as soon as possible. And I think they're just around the corner. So, you know, with things like this wonderful podcast and, you know, that go out there to the world and people listening, and hopefully people will say, you know what, I'm going to write that letter. I'm going to get the kids to choose an SDG, and they're going to write a letter to a real person. You know, those tiny little things, they have trickle effects and a knock-on effect. And hopefully together, you know, we can do this as a teaching, you know, as a unified teaching, you know, cohort. We can move forward collectively.
And I think the other thing about those things that you mentioned is that none of those can be measured. And that's a good thing, you know, for the future of where we want our kids to be kind of taking experiences and learning how to be great young people, you know, in the future. Now it's time for my favorite segment of the day. Nat, I've got some, you know, oh, yes, the crowd's excited.
Wow.
The quick fire five.
You're excited, Luke. I'm not sure Matt's, Gavin and I are excited.
Matt's about rolling.
We'll see how we go.
What do we have to do in this section?
Matt's rolling his eyes at me. It's one word or idea around five little areas. So let's crack on. One educational narrative that's been underrated or overrated in the past decade.
God, I don't know. It's very hard. It's a very hard question to answer.
That's an answer in itself. That's fun.
I can't pinpoint it. I think there's... I'm going to be talking for 25 minutes.
That's exactly right.
Now, that is against the rules. That's against the rules.
But he didn't break them. He actually just said, I'd be here for another 20 minutes, so move on.
Yeah.
It's all good. Yeah.
All right. What's one thing you're most proud of during your career?
Writing a children's book.
Do you want to give it a quick plug?
No, it's all good.
What does student success look like when they leave your school?
Being confident to try something new and having the resilience to fail and try again.
One book worth reading.
Goodness me, that's a very hard one. Plato and a Platypus Walked into a Bar. It's an amazing book.
And lastly, one person you'd like to hear us interview on the podcast.
Oh, that's a really good one. Yes. I would love, goodness me, there's so many people to choose from. Goodness me, who to on your podcast? Do they have to be Australian?
No, not at all.
Don't have to be Australian. A lady called Christine Sanders. She is an educator from the north of England, from a place called Preston. She came to university with me, but she's done some amazing stuff. I'll hit her up as soon as this is over. She's awesome.
That would be amazing. Well, that brings an end to our show for today. I hope you've enjoyed our wide-ranging chat with Gavin. I know I've certainly found, you know, your enthusiasm for education and life more broadly, you know, amazing. Matt, any closing comments?
I love that notion of freedom within limits and say yes. And so in my role, I say no about 150 times, mainly to staff. So for me today, I'm going to say yes to every idea that comes into my office, every opportunity that comes into my office. I was just really inspired by that and that notion that we, you know, we drive professional trust, you know, in our teachers by what we model. So thank you for inspiring me today, Gavin. Cheers.
I'll give you a tip. I've got a T-shirt and it says yes in massive letters on it, just YES. And I said to the kids, if you've got a question, just look at my T-shirt and then that's your answer. Oh. So I'd be working, doing some little work with some little kids, and I'd see children walking over like to co-ask me, and they'd see the T-shirt and go, oh yeah, I've got the answers on your T-shirt. I'm going back.
I'm getting that shirt. And then I'm actually going to have a reverse bit that just says no on the back as well. Just when I... freedom, there's got to be limits, right? Freedom within limits.
Of course. But you might get dizzy. You might fall over and knock your head.
Yes.
And for me, I particularly like, and you did it throughout the podcast today, that power of story. You know, the stories that we tell, our authentic stories that we have ourselves as educators, the power of stories amongst other educators, you know, and I think it's a good reminder how much power there is in a story and what people can take away from that, the engagement they can take away that from that, the enthusiasm that they can take away from that. And it's through stories that, you know, as you say, we can change, you know, the paradigm of education and what's happening in the world. Gavin, thank you so much for being on the show today, giving up your time to share kind of your journey and your leadership and what you've done with our audience. If the audience out there hasn't heard of you, I'm sure that 95% of them have, but if they haven't, what's the best way of them of following your journey?
You can just find me on the internet everywhere. Just Google.
Basically, get a blog. He's everywhere. And, you know, he's everywhere.
No, I'm not everywhere. But what I would say to you is, what I would say to your listeners is, you talked about the Arctic. We're about to release the Arctic course, October the 10th. It comes out on upschool.co, and literally there is a curriculum written for you, K-6, done. There is every lesson done for you, every differentiated task arc, extension activities, videos live from the Arctic, polar bears, Antarctica. It's totally free, completely free for your entire school. Term 4 is done for you, no problem. And it's all packed with agency, independence, real world learning. You'll love it. You know, you absolutely love it. And well, I hope you'll love it. So I would, I would encourage you to go and have a look and see what you think.
Excellent. I definitely recommend heading to that website and following Gavin on LinkedIn. He always has interesting and thought-provoking content on there. And remember, if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show and don't forget to share the love. Tell a few of your colleagues, send an email to them, tell them that you listen to this great podcast called Ed Leaders. You can also sign up to edleaders.com.au or follow Ed Leaders on LinkedIn, where you can keep up to date with all the latest. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next week.